Welcome, of course, to the Summit Church this weekend at all 11 campuses here in the Triangle. And those of you that are joining us live stream and in other ways, it is, of course, officially now the Christmas season. So get out your Bibles if you have them and open them to the book of Revelation, where we are going to spend the next few weeks in what might be the most unusual Christmas series that you have ever heard. But I assure you, in moments of doubt, it is indeed a Christmas series. And personally, I am very, very excited about it. Most of you, I realize, are not that familiar with the book of Revelation. To you, it probably seems like the Lord of the Rings installment here in the New Testament, and you are not quite sure exactly what to do with it. But I was very familiar growing up with the book of Revelation because the Christian tradition that I grew up in, that was the Christian school that I went to, was pretty obsessed with the book of Revelation because we were really obsessed with the end times. We had our charts and our timelines and with our depictions of the last days, our educated guesses about which political figures and which Hollywood stars were represented by the various beasts in Revelation. We had our annual prophecy conferences. It was the highlight of our church calendar every year. We had our end time movies. We had our rapture board games. None of that is a joke. I personally was particularly obsessed with the rapture, which is the belief that Jesus will come again in the clouds one day, and believers will rise to meet him in the air, after which point Jesus will unleash basically hell on earth for the space of 7 years called the tribulation. And so, as a young boy, 5, 6, 7 years old, if for any reason at all I could not find my parents in the house or they did not respond to me calling out, I would run through the house in a panic, just sure that I would find my mother's clothes neatly in a little pile as she has ascended to be with Jesus, because that's always how it happened in the movies. They always left their clothes behind, which I'm not sure why we thought of it. Everybody's going to fly through the atmosphere naked, but that's just how we saw it. Anyway, there was a book. Oh, by the way, I had this recurring dream. I kid you not. I had this recurring dream when I was about that age that the rapture happened. And this was like the worst nightmare I had as a kid. The rapture happened and, Jesus is there, blows the trumpet, and we all begin to ascend up to him. And I get to the top of our house and then I fall back down to the floor because that was kind of like just how good of a Christian I was, and to the ceiling and no farther. And so that was the world that I grew up in. There was a book that came out when I was in high school that became an instant bestseller. It was called 88 Reasons Why Jesus is Coming Back in 1988, specifically on September 11th, 12th, and 13th of 1988. It was during the week in the Jewish calendar called Rosh Hashanah. It was put out by a guy named Edgar Wisnett. He was a NASA engineer. And so you had spaceships and scripture. That was a perfect recipe for capturing the attentions of superstitious Christians. This thing sold 2 million copies in the space of just a few weeks. Now, of course, a lot of people pushed back on Edgar Wisnett and said, hey man, the Bible clearly says that no man knows the day or the hour of Jesus' return. And Edgar Wisnett's response was, hey, I don't know the day or the hour, I just know the week. It's going to be a September 11th through 13th, but the day or the hour, that's still a mystery. I went to a Christian school, and September 11th through 13th was right at the beginning of soccer season. September 13th, if my memory serves me correctly, was a Tuesday. And so at the end of our soccer practice, our coach pulled us in about 15 minutes early and said, hey, it's September 13th. That's the last day. So we're going to just sit here on the bleachers and we're going to wait and see if Jesus returns. He said, and if he does, JD, make sure that all the equipment gets back into the gym and locked up and make sure that's taken care of. Well, that's not a joke. That is exactly what he said. Suffice it to say that September 11th through 13th came and went. You would have thought, of course, that would have been the end of Edgar Wisnett's teaching ministry, but the next year he came out with a book claiming he had just done the math wrong. It was entitled 89 Reasons Why Jesus is Coming Back in 1989. I kid you not, I own that copy as well in my library. Now, I realize that you may not have had that experience exactly. Some of you did, but I also know for a fact that some of you still have some Y2K food tucked into a closet somewhere, and I know a bunch of you own every single volume of the Left Behind series, so I know that there are some of you that at least resonate a little bit with what I'm talking about. Personally, I am glad we are not obsessed like that at this church, but I actually think we might fall into an opposite and maybe even more pernicious error. And that is, most Christians in churches like ours rarely, if ever, think about the second coming of Christ at all. But I want you to understand this. The second coming of Christ is the most talked about doctrine in the Bible. The Bible talks about the first coming of Christ a measly 129 times. And we got a whole holiday for that one called Christmas. It's the biggest holiday of the year. Yet the New Testament alone talks about the second coming of Christ 329 times. And we rarely even mention it. For every one prophecy in the Bible concerning Christ's first advent, there are eight that talk about his second. And really, to even understand his first advent, what we call Christmas, you've got to see it through the lens of his second, which is what the book of Revelation is all about. Now, the bad news is, disappointing news, is that we do not have time for a full series through Revelation. That is definitely on my future sermon wish list for another day. But I wanted to take the next 4 weeks as we head into Christmas to look at glimpses of Jesus that are given to us in the book of Revelation. Because you see, that is really what the book of Revelation is all about. Who Jesus is and who he is indicates about what the future holds for all of us, okay? In fact, look at the very first verse. You'll see this established in the first verse. John, the Apostle John. Apostle John wrote five books in the Bible. Revelation, the Gospel of John, and then 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, the three letters in the New Testament. So John tells you what he wants to do in this book in the very first verse. This is, he says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must soon take place. Revelation means unveiling. This is the unveiling of Jesus Christ. But an immediate question comes out of this verse. What is it that is being revealed? What is the revelation of? Is it a revelation of Jesus Christ as if Jesus himself is being revealed? Or is it a revelation that Jesus Christ is doing of something else? Do you understand the question? If I told you this morning we were going to have the presentation of Hank Murphy, does that mean that we are going to present Hank Murphy to you? Or does that mean that Hank Murphy's going to stand up here and present his solar system he made that won the science fair? Because, you know, he's still in high school. So is that what I mean? Right? So is it the revelation of Jesus, or is it a revelation by Jesus of these future things? And the answer is yes, yes. The way it is written in Greek, scholars tell us, is deliberately ambiguous because the book of Revelation is both a revelation of Jesus, who he is, that's the most important part, and a revelation of what he sees about the future and what his role is in that future. You see, the main point of Revelation is not to give you a specific timeline of events or to help you figure out which beast is Vladimir Putin or Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, although that sounds like a pretty vicious three-headed beast to me. If you ask me, the point is to pull back the curtain of history so that you can see the powers at work behind the politics on earth. People read the book of Revelation with all the dragons and the beasts, and they imagine that it is this delusional fantasy world. But what Revelation is doing is looking at the world through spiritual eyes to show you the powers that are at work behind the powers that you see. It is, in fact, one of the most accurate depictions of the world that you will ever encounter. It is the unveiling. It is the unmasking of what is really going on, where you see the real identities of what is happening out there. It is the unveiling of both the powers at work in the world and the unveiling of Jesus's power above them all. As I was studying it this week, it reminded me of one of my favorite Nicolas Cage movies, Face Off. You're like, is that really your favorite? Yes, next to The Rock, Raising Arizona, Family Man, Con Air, and both National Treasures, it is absolutely my favorite. Nicolas Cage, this is a little bit older movie, you may not be familiar with this one. Nicolas Cage works for the government, I think. He's some kind of weapons specialist. And so John Travolta, who's the bad guy, wants to get access to these weapons. So Nicolas Cage has an accident, goes into a coma. And so John Travolta gets the doctor to take off Nicolas Cage's face and put it onto him, right? Because they're about the same size. And so Nicolas Cage wakes up from the coma without a face, which is always a bad day. So he gets the doctor to put John Travolta's face on him. And so throughout the movie, they're going around and everybody thinks that John Travolta's Nicolas Cage and Nicolas Cage is John Travolta. And so the climax of the movie is when they are unveiled, unmasked, and you see which one is actually who. You see who's the bad guy and who is the good guy. Well, what you got in Revelation is the unveiling, the face-off of the New Testament, where you see that the ones that looked like they had power didn't actually have power, and the one you thought had no power actually had all the power. And so the Book of Revelation is the face-off of the New Testament. And I realize that I might get my seminary degree revoked for that analogy. I'm fully aware of that. But I've always wanted to be able to say that Jesus was the truer and better Nicolas Cage, and so that's about as close as I can get. All right, you see, the church at this point in history, the church in Revelation is not really doing particularly well. I know you got these glorious images of the early church, and it was awesome, and they were just singing Kumbaya. That is not true. The church is not doing well, especially John, the author of the book of Revelation. All of the other apostles have been martyred by this point, except for John. And John has been exiled on the Isle of Patmos, which is the Roman equivalent of Alcatraz. John had been tortured. Eusebius, the church historian in the third century, said that John had been tortured with one of the Romans' worst torture techniques. They put him into a scalding pot of oil and then slowly heated it up until it came to a boiling point. And right before it killed him, they pulled him out. And they would have done this repeatedly. His skin would have been marred. He wouldn't have even looked like himself. He would have lived in constant pain. Christians were scared all over the empire because Nero had made Christians the scapegoat for a number of Rome's calamities, and then he'd used that as a pretext for hunting them down and killing them. And then one of Nero's successors, Emperor Domitian, was preparing to unleash, John knew, a far worse persecution against Christians unless they would worship Caesar as Lord, which of course they could not do. And so John, from his remote isle in Patmos, John can see these storm clouds of tribulation beginning to build up on the horizon. This was not a great day to be a Christian. And so there on this lonely, forsaken isle of Patmos, Jesus appears to John in his prison cell. And Jesus gives to John a revelation of who he is and what he is doing in all of this. Now I realize this weekend that most of us are not facing the same kinds of persecution or any of the kinds of persecution that John and those early Christians were facing. It is not illegal where we live to follow Jesus. Now, of course, I should hasten to add that for some of those listening our live stream, many of our missionaries are in places where it is illegal to be a Christian. But for most of us, it is not illegal where we live to confess and to follow Jesus. But regardless, we wrestle with many of the same questions that John and those early Christians had. Because many of you face powers at work right now, powers in your life that you believe vastly overwhelm your own. And when you look into the future of your life, you can see storm clouds beginning to rise on the horizon, or maybe you're in one now and you don't see any way out of it. That might come in the form of a chronic illness. Maybe something that you've prayed for healing for and you can't understand why Jesus hasn't given it to you and it doesn't look like it's going anywhere. Or maybe you're beginning to walk through divorce, or maybe you just concluded a divorce, or maybe it comes in the form of an addiction that you can't shake. Maybe it's a problem with one of your kids and for the first time you feel totally helpless. You're like, if I could choose for them, I would, but I can't make these decisions and I just feel overwhelmed. Or maybe it's just a dark cloud of anxiety or depression that just hovers over your life and seems to follow you wherever you go. And now along comes Christmas, this season, which is supposedly all about happiness and good cheer. But truth be told, you can't stand this season anymore because all it does is remind you of the empty place at your table that's not supposed to be empty. Or it reminds you of the broken relationship that you thought was going to last forever that is no more. Maybe you came into this place this weekend and you're just ready to give up. In fact, if you were honest, you're not even sure why you're here. You certainly did not come in this weekend looking for some kind of hope. You're long past good cheer and long past looking for some kind of hope. I need you to understand that as strange as it sounds, John wrote the book of Revelation for you. He was thinking about you when he wrote this book. You know how I know that? Revelation 1:9. Here's what John said. I, John, your brother and companion in suffering. I'm writing this for those of you who, like me, are in the midst of pain and you are suffering. Which means if your life is going hunky-dory, everything's fine, you got no problems, there's not much in Revelation that's going to help you. But if you this morning are in pain or you are looking into your future and what you see are the dark clouds of tribulation and it looks like they're in front of you, John's got something to say to you. Here's what it is, verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet, and I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands. Those, you're going to find out, represent the churches, the seven churches that depict all churches in the first century there in Revelation. And in the midst of the lampstands, one, like the Son of Man, Jesus, clothed with a long robe with a golden sash around his chest. Those are images that conjure up the high priest of the Old Testament. What John is saying is that Jesus is the ultimate high priest. He's what everything in the Bible was pointing to. He's our representative before God. Verse 14, the hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace. His voice was like the roar of many waters. Verse 16, in his right hand he held seven stars. You're going to find out those represents the leaders of those seven churches, and Jesus holding them is showing his presence with the church, his control over it. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. We go from symbols that depict the high priest of the Old Testament to these images of ultimate power and control. You see, white hair in those days symbolized wisdom. So saying that Jesus has brilliant white hair like snow means that he is wiser than the wise. Having eyes of fire means that his insight penetrates more deeply than the sharpest laser. Having a face that's brighter than the brightest sun, or a voice that is louder than the loudest ocean, which, you know, communicates not just decibel level, but volume and intensity and fullness, is saying that this is a person whose power just goes beyond anything John can imagine. His words are like a sword, which means they possess the ability to pierce, to separate truth from fiction, to separate into parts and to destroy. The seven stars he holds, I told you in chapter 2, you'll see these are the leaders of the seven churches, which symbolizes Jesus being in the midst of all the turmoil and holding securely the church in his hands in this hour of tribulation. John says, verse 17, when I saw him, I fell at his feet as though I were dead. Now, I want you to keep in mind that this is the first time John has seen Jesus since the ascension. And if you know much about the New Testament, you might know that Jesus and John had been BFFs on earth. Jesus loved all the apostles, of course, but he had three that were particularly close to him, Peter, James, and John. And you can make a very compelling argument that of the three of those, Peter, James, and John, John was the closest to Jesus. You got a couple of pieces of evidence here. The first one is that whenever John refers to himself in the Gospel of John, one of the other books he wrote, he never refers to himself by name. He always refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, which I always thought took a lot of nerve to actually put into print. Imagine that as his email signature in those first days. Like, hey, Jesus likes you guys too, but I'm his favorite. People are like, well, what does that mean? Why does it? Let me give you serious for a minute what it actually means. The way it's written in Greek is it's the disciple that Jesus kept on loving. And it's a reference to the statement John made in the Gospel of John that Jesus loved his disciples until the end. And what John is saying is, even after I failed him over and over and over and over again, even after I walked away from him, he kept on loving me. And I am just amazed by that. And so it's a statement about Jesus's grace, not about his being in the favorite position. But that doesn't change the fact that John and Jesus were super close, maybe even more close than the other disciples. Because here's the other piece of evidence. John 13, at the Last Supper, John says that he reached back and reclined his head and leaned it on Jesus's chest. Now, y'all, I got some guy friends that I feel pretty close to, okay? But ain't a one of them close enough that they would lean their head back on my chest during dinner. If so, that is a fundamental redefinition of the relationship. There is one man, one young man, who would do that. And if he did that, I wouldn't think twice about it. Neither would he. And that man is my son. Young man is my son. That's the kind of relationship that John felt with Jesus. It was more than just friend. It was like a child in some ways with his very protective and loving father. Suffice it to say, Jesus and John were close. And y'all, this is the first time that they have seen each other in 60 years. What's that reunion look like? He falls at Jesus' feet as though he had died. And that's not even intended, y'all, to be a figure of speech. He literally thought he was going to die. You know, I grew up with this image of Jesus that came from these pictures that we had up in our Sunday school classroom or our Christian school classroom. There, back in those days when I was a kid, there was only like two or three of these pictures. Like, I think everybody had the same one. You know the one I'm talking about, right? The picture of Jesus looks like an Olin Mills, you know, picture. And it's Jesus with this perfect kind of olive skin. And he's got this beautiful, you know, robe on and not a blemish on his face anywhere. Nice full lips. Got this, you know, kind of a Brooke Shields looking, you know, beautiful wavy hair. He's got this expression on his face. Like he just saw a bird fly by. Or you know what I'm talking about? Right, just beautiful hair. I mean, it's kind of an image like this, right? Hey, I told you, it's big gift weekend, okay? Big gift weekend, that's free for you all. All right, so anyway, I just grew up with this image of Jesus as this like sad, jobless guy who wandered around Israel in his flip-flops, you know, talking about his feelings all the time. Well, y'all, first of all, I don't know where we get that image come from anyway, because Jesus was a carpenter, a table maker, which means as far as guys go, he would have been rugged. He probably would have been pretty buff, but that is definitely not the image that we're getting of Jesus here in the book of Revelation. I mean, what you got a guy, just take it at face value, you got a guy with wild hair. He's got a crazy look in his eye. just taking it at face value. That's not the kind of guy you ever want to run into in a back alley. And then when you understand the symbolism, you realize all this is pointing to somebody so powerful that John in his presence feels like he's going to die. Now, is this a different Jesus than the one John had known? The one he leaned his head back on during dinner? No. No, it's just that when Jesus was on earth, and even now in our day, part of Jesus is veiled. Part of Jesus is invisible to the naked eye. Truth is, truth be told, Jesus has always had the power that you see demonstrated in Revelation 1. Always had it. It's just that during his ministry on earth and during our day and in John's day, part of that power had been veiled. Every once in a while, it breaks out and you see it. For example, I was thinking this week about one of the quaint little miracles Jesus did that everybody's like, oh, isn't that nice? And let's talk about this in Vacation Bible School. The feeding of the 5,000. Every kid knows about this miracle. It just seems awesome. He shows up. He's got 5 loaves and 2 fish. And everybody gets food and everybody goes home happy. And we're like, oh, isn't that quaint? Okay, I read an article this week by a scientist who I actually read a few years ago, reread it this week, of a scientist who was talking about how much power it would have taken to create the food to feed the 5,000. Right, because it says that Jesus pretty much created this food out of thin air. He created matter out of thin air. And we know that matter can either be created or destroyed, matter and energy. So you had to use energy to create the matter. So this guy calculated that if every one of the 5,000 ate 8 ounces of food, which is a pretty conservative estimate, using Einstein's famous theory that E equals mc squared, he came up with concluded that the amount of energy necessary to create that much matter, to create food to feed the 5,000, would be equivalent, get this, to all the electrical power available on Earth working at 100% output, 100% of the time, for 4 years straight, just to create the energy necessary to create the matter for that meal. Go back and read John 6. Jesus does it without even breaking a sweat. The point is, the power is always there. You just can't see it. It was veiled. And now, here it is, Revelation 1, unveiled in all of its splendor. So the question is, why is Jesus appearing this way now to John? Why not appear to him as the way John knew him on earth? Why not come up and give him this embrace and this tender hug and let him lean his head back on his chest in dinner? Listen, it's because Jesus' plan right now is not to deliver his church from persecution and pain. Jesus is not showing up to John with the news, hey, John, don't worry. Don't worry, man, it gets better. It's not going to get better, at least not in the short run. So instead, Jesus shows John his power, his majesty, and his love so that John can hope in that power, majesty, and love in the midst of this kind of tribulation. You see, in times of persecution, you don't need a sentimental Jesus who simply makes you feel warm at night. A Jesus who is one part genie, one part therapist, one part life coach, and the rest warm blanket. You need, in the midst of tribulation, you need a Jesus who is sovereign over all the other powers that are at work in the world. Watch what happens next. Watch what happens. Verse 17. But this Jesus laid his right hand on me and said, fear not, John. I'm the first and the last. Now we saw in the book of Colossians what first and last meant, right? It meant that Jesus is God. And John's like, if Jesus is first, it means he's there at the beginning. And if Jesus is first and he's God, it means he'll be there at the end. And if he's God present at the beginning and God present at the end, I'm pretty sure he's God that's in charge of the middle part as well, right? Right? If Jesus is going to be the last one standing when it's all said and done, and he was the first one before it began, then I'm pretty sure that he's in control of what's happening now. So how he unpacks this. Verse 18, I'm the living one. I died. Behold, Jesus said, I'm alive forevermore. I conquered death, and I've got the keys now of death and Hades or hell. You realize that the one who has the keys has the power. Earlier this year, I was at going to a conference at a hotel. One of these hotels where they have the really nice rooms where some, people pay a lot of money. And so it valets its cars, right? And so, have you ever noticed at these hotels that if you drive a really, really nice car, they'll park it right up front, so everybody can see how expensive the cars are, the people who stay at the hotel. And if you drive cars like the ones I rent, they park them way back in the back of the garage. So they're walking into this hotel and there's a Lamborghini. Now, y'all, I try to respect people's privacy. I really do. But I mean, come on, dudes. It's a Lamborghini. So I'm over there, I'm looking in, I'm trying to get every way, and look at that, watch, it's amazing, all this. All of a sudden, as I'm like, this far from it, thing starts up. Nobody in it. I'm like, what just happened? Right, I look over and there's a dude leaning up against the back wall. He's got the little electronic starter in his hand. What's he trying to tell me? He's trying to like, bro, you could admire that power all you want, but you ain't going anywhere in it, right? That thing belongs to me. I got the key, and if I'm the one with the key, that thing ain't going to go anywhere unless I go or unless I give it permission to go. What Jesus is doing is Revelation 1 is saying, John, you may feel overwhelmed by that power, but I'm the one with the keys right here. And not a thing happens with that power outside of my control or outside of my permission. It's all my servants now just serving my purposes. And what that means, John, is that the power of the empire, Nero's power, the power of Domitian, or the powers at work in our life, the power of our government, the power of Hollywood, the power of your boss, the power of cancer, it's all just an illusion. He holds the key. Psalm 76, God makes even the wrath of sinful men to praise him. Proverbs 21:1, the heart of the most powerful king is like a river in the hand of the Lord. He turns it whatever way he chooses. The logic is if God is in control of even the wrath of sinful men and in control of the hearts of the most powerful kings, then surely he's got everything else under control in your life as well. Ephesians chapter 1, I memorized this chapter a couple of years ago with some buddies, and I was going back this week trying to think if I could say it, you know, because it's been a couple of years since I memorized it. I'm a little actually disturbed, to be honest with you, because maybe it's just getting older and just how your memory works, but I just hacked my way through this thing. I do not have it memorized anymore. But there's one phrase in Ephesians 1 that I cannot get out of my mind. One phrase that bounces around in there all the time and just shows up in the most random times in my consciousness and comes out, it seems like, just when I need it. And it is this phrase in Ephesians 1:11. We have been predestined, Paul says, according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Now, y'all, like you, I got some questions about what predestination is all about. I really do. But there's two things in that verse I do understand. Number one, God's got a purpose in my life, and that he is using all things in my life, everything according to that purpose, which means there's not one stray molecule, there's not one stray cancer cell, there's not one stray spouse, not one stray child that is not under his ultimate control. Or here's another one. Are not two sparrows, Jesus said, sold for a penny? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. The very hairs of your head are all numbered. Right? I mean, for some of you guys, that's much easier now for Jesus than it used to be. But the point is, you don't get much more micro than the birds in the air and the hairs on your head. And Jesus is saying, yet not even one of them is going to come out or fall down apart from the will of your Father. Now, I want to be very, very careful here, because I am not saying that God is the one that is making all these things happen to you. We live in a fallen world. In a world where people get free choices, and a world that is under the curse of sin. And the result of that is that a lot of people do a lot of terrible things to each other. And I'm not saying that God is the one that is behind those things. What I am saying is that Jesus promises that none of those things, not one of them, are outside of his control. And he promises to use, to redeem every single one of them as a part of his perfect purposes in your life, because he holds the keys to death and hell. Like John, you might feel like you are upon the precipice of tribulation. Like John, you might feel like the purposes God is pursuing are a mystery to you, and they might remain a mystery to you until eternity. But the resurrection of Jesus and this vision of Jesus in Revelation 1 assures you that there is a purpose that Jesus is pursuing, and he will not fail to fulfill any of it. I've heard it described before, and I've used this with you. Or to describe like a tapestry. You see these ginormous tapestries in these castles in England or Germany or somewhere like that, and they're just beautiful in their intricacy, and there's not any strand that seems out of place. Just this beautiful work of art until you look at the backside of it. And the backside looks like a chaotic mess with strings going every possible way. What looks like order on one side looks like chaos on the other. John's life feels like chaos. Feels like strands are going every direction. And what Jesus is showing John is that there's coming a day when I flip it all over. And when I flip it all over, you'll see that not one strand was out of place, that I was doing what I was doing in the world to reveal the beauty of my perfect son. I was revealing his church in the world, and I was revealing Jesus in you, and all things that were working in your life were working to that glorious end. That is the vision that God gives to us and to John in the midst of tribulation. You see, the world that you and I live in now, the world we live in now, is characterized by Jesus's first coming. And what was Jesus's first coming like? What was it like? Right? We expected, everybody expected it would be like Revelation 1. That's what they thought Jesus was going to come like, but he didn't. He came as a baby in a manger, born in poverty, born under a system of oppression, one of the worst that had ever existed. Jesus was a victim of injustice. Jesus' parents had to flee their homeland as refugees for the first several years of Jesus' life. Every single day of Jesus' life, he lived under the subjugation of Rome. That is still the epoch of history that we are in, which means that like Jesus, we will many times find ourselves in hardship. We will find ourselves to be the victims of injustice, suffering, we think, unnecessarily, subject to the powers of Rome. And listen, people who try to tell you that being a Christian means escaping all of that, they're not telling you the truth. So Jesus pulls back the veil. He just pulls back the veil for John really quickly, and he gives him a glimpse of who he is. Because he died for John, and because he overcame death for John, and because he holds the keys, and because he's the one standing at the end, he says, John, you can know in the middle part that I'm faithfully working out all my purposes. Or you might say it this way, because he's the one standing at the end, I can sure be sure he's got a plan in the present. Because he was there at the beginning, because he's there at the end, I know he's in charge in the middle. I had a friend who told me the other day, a friend my age, says, hey, we were talking about what shows we were watching on TV. He's like, man, I'm watching this show. You ever seen it? It's called 24. I'm like, bro, where were you the entire decade of like 2000 to 2010? He's like, oh, you've seen it. I'm like, yeah, we've all seen it. He said, man, it's great. I was like, what season are you in? He's like, we're in season 3. My wife and I said, has Jack died yet? Now, you might think that that's cruel, but y'all, I mean, he's 10 years behind. That ain't nothing on me on that, right? And so I was like, he's like, he dies? I'm like, yeah, he dies. Right? And I feel good because you know there's like 19 seasons of this show. There's another one coming out, by the way. You know there's like all these seasons. You know that something, you know, he's not really dead. So, because I remembered my wife and I, when we were 4 or 5 years behind because we're kind of late adopters and stuff like this, and people were talking about it. So we're like, well, let's watch it. So you know, back then, you couldn't just stream it on Netflix because it wasn't as advanced. So you had to get the actual boxes with the DVDs in it. Y'all remember this? And so I got like 5 seasons from somebody, 5 seasons in the box. And my wife and I, we planned this couples retreat where we could go and work on our relationship. And for 4 days, for 9 to 10 hours straight, we watched seasons of 24, just worked our way through these things. And I remember, I think it was season 3, if my memory is right, middle of season 3, Jack dies. Or you think he dies. And I remember my wife and I just like, you know, looking at this thing, and I was like, I paused it and I'm like, I think he just died. And Veronica's like, I think he died too. And I was like, and I looked down because beside me, beside the chair, I reached up and I put, because it was season 4 and Jack's face was on the front of the box. And the season 5, pick up season, Jack's face was on the front of that box. I'm like, Veronica, Jack's face is on season 4 and season 5. I think something sinister is afoot, right? And he looks dead. He ain't really dead. Because the bad guys look like they're in charge right now, right? They look like they got Jack in a bad way, but the bad guys aren't the ones writing the script. Somebody else wrote the script, and the people that wrote the script put Jack on season 4 and season 5, which tells me he's going to be fine. What Jesus is showing John in Revelation 1 is, hey, final season, my face is still the one on the box, okay? So it might look like the bad guys are in charge right now, but they ain't writing the script. I'm writing the script, and it looks like they're in charge, but I'm the one that's in charge because I'm on the front of the box. So what Jesus says to John is like, look, John, look at me. Look at me. Look at my face. I am more powerful than you could ever imagine. John, look at me. I died for you, which means you know that I'm committed to you. And I got the keys of death and hell. John, you might not understand what's going on in your suffering. You might not understand what your suffering means. But you can know for sure what your suffering doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that I've lost my love for you or my compassion. It doesn't mean that I've lost control. Because you saw my compassion demonstrated on the cross. You see my power in the resurrection. You see it demonstrated here in Revelation 1. So take that option off the table. John, look at me. John, I use my greatest power to save you. Of course, I'm not going to abandon you. John, if I did not spare my life to purchase you from slavery to sin, I'm not going to withhold my power in pursuing my purposes for you. So, John, what are you afraid of? John, are you really afraid of Caesar? You think Caesar is winning? The only legacy Caesar is going to leave on earth is a cheap pizza place that's going to hub itself out of a gas station. Nero? Like, really, you're afraid of Nero? John, did you know that one day your name will be the most common name for young boys in the English language, the most populated or the most spoken language on earth? Nero, people will call their dogs Nero, and they'll name their sons John. Don't be afraid of Nero. John, look at me. Look at me. I got the keys to death and hell. I got the keys to death and hell. Do you not think I can't control cancer? I got the keys to that too. Hey, you think I don't know that you need a job? I got the keys to that. Hey, I know you think I don't know that you're worried about your marriage. I've got the keys to that. John, look at me. Look at my power. Look at my control. Look at my love. John, why do you doubt? In fact, you know the thing I probably most love about the Apostle John? There is no other Bible writer, Old or New Testament, that teaches us more about the love of God than John. Paul was the early church's greatest theologian, no question about it. But not even Paul holds a candle when it comes to John teaching us about God's love. Paul talked about Jesus' death on the cross, and he explained it in terms of God, you know, restoring right and justice and God's glory and stuff that's really important. How does John talk about it? God so loved the world. God just couldn't get over you. And so God gave his only son because he wanted you to be with him in eternity. 1 John 3:1, behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God. 1 John 4:8, God is love. God is love. And those who know God, those who encounter God, they encounter that kind of love. Now, here's what I want to ask John. How could you say that? Right? I mean, because Patmos didn't feel like love, did it? The emperor didn't feel like love. Nero didn't feel like love. His being boiled in oil didn't feel like love. Yesterday didn't feel like love. Today doesn't feel like love. Tomorrow doesn't look like it's going to be love. How could John say God is love? Well, John tells you, 1 John chapter 1, that which our eyes have seen and our ears have heard and our hands have handled, I have felt the warmth in the embrace of Jesus. I have sensed the tenderness of his friendship. I have seen the love in his eyes. And yeah, I know right now it doesn't feel like love, but it is love because I saw him and I know him. And then I saw him in Revelation 1 and I saw that he was standing over all these powers on earth and there was not a single power that was not under his control. So I know it looks like he's not in control, but he is. And it may not feel to you like love. It may feel like things are out of control, but I can assure you, I've seen the cross, I've seen the resurrection, and I've seen the final season, Revelation 1, and I can tell you, it's love. It don't feel like love, but it's love because God is love, because Jesus was love, because we saw that when we saw Jesus. You see, I have this sense that this morning, this weekend, some of you need to see Jesus this way. Some of you come in here, like I said, with just these storm clouds of tribulation, going into this season, and you really, really, really want to hear me say, you want to hear me say, hey, you know what? God's going to end all this. If you're a good Christian, you'll do what you're supposed to do. God will take all these clouds of tribulation away. But you understand, that's not necessarily true, at least not in the short run, right? I mean, God is a miracle-working God. I've seen God heal the sick. I've seen God repair marriages that everybody thought was beyond repair. I've seen God bring back children who are wandering away. I've seen God do some incredible things. But I know that sometimes when you pray, God doesn't make the storm clouds of tribulation disappear. And see, you need a theology that accounts for that. You might think you want a theology that promises that if you're just a good person, then God will remove all the problems in your life. But here's the thing. You'll never actually come to know Jesus that way. And that's why Jesus allows us sometimes to go through these times of tribulation. Because James 1 says it is the tribulation of your faith, the trial of your faith that actually produces patience and faith in you. And that it's when you go through this kind of thing that you learn how dependable Jesus really is and you start really pressing into him. So count it all joy, my brothers and sisters, when you go into tribulation. Don't bemoan Jesus or don't bemoan your lack of faith. You should count it joy because God is using that time to take you deeper into him and to teach you to know something that is better than a great job and better than great health and better than a great marriage. And that's Jesus himself. And you'll never know that if you don't go through this storm of tribulation. That's what he's doing. That's what he's doing with many of you right now. I know you'd love for me to tell you it's going to go away, but I can tell you that's not always going to happen. But what he'll do is he'll give you a glimpse of who he is. Isaiah, the prophet, says that what God wants from us is he wants us to be oaks of righteousness. Now, I love that imagery of an oak. An oak is a really strong tree, right? Usually when a hurricane comes through, it's not the oaks that are the ones that are torn down. And there's a reason for that, they say, and that is because an oak has this way it's wired up that whenever a storm comes, it makes the root of that oak tree go a little bit deeper. It's kind of unique among trees. It makes it press that root in deeper. And so as an oak goes through more and more storms, its roots get deeper and deeper to eventually it can withstand some of the worst hurricane winds because of how deep its roots go. When God says, I want you to be an oak of righteousness, what he's saying to you is, I don't want you to be blown apart by every storm that comes along. I want you to be able to walk into tribulation and say, he's better. He's faithful. He's bigger. He's bigger. And I know this because I've been through this hour of tribulation. And yeah, God eventually brought me out of it, but it didn't happen when I thought it was going to happen, but it's better. You don't get stronger in Jesus sitting on a beach. You get stronger going through a storm. It's not mountaintops, high, reading books, listening to podcasts that makes you strong in Jesus. It's walking through these kinds of places of trial. Now listen, I acknowledge to you, I acknowledge that these problems that many of you are going through right now are real, and they could take you out. Cancer's real, and it could take you out. Divorce is real, and it can take you out. A spouse abandoning you can take you out. Addiction is real and can take you out. Abuse is real. It can take you out. Losing a child is real and it can take you out. I'm just here to tell you that Jesus is real too. In fact, he's more real than all those things and his power is above all of those things. And every once in a while, Jesus will do to you what he does to John. He'll just give you a glimpse. And so I'm eventually going to bring you out of this, and the day is coming where eye has not seen nor his ear heard, nor is entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those who love him, and I'll wipe away every tear out of every eye, and it's going to be awesome. But for right now, what I'm going to give you is a glimpse of who I am, and you're going to see who I am, and you're going to see that in the midst of this trial, you can trust in my sovereignty and my love. Listen, I'm not trying to give you some little quick spiritual one-size-fits-all band-aid to slap on your problem. I get that some of you have problems that are very complex, and some of you need professional help, and we would love to help you find that. I'm just trying to say that what John gets invited into is a vision of Jesus that is above, that is bigger, that is stronger than all the powers that are against him. The Christian counselor, Larry Crabb, says, I love Revelation 1 for counseling. Because on the island of Patmos, Jesus did not give John relief from dire circumstances. Instead, he gave John an unforgettable vision of the Son of God. This weekend, many of you need to stop shouting so much at your tribulation or shouting at Jesus in the middle of your tribulation, and you need to start gazing at your Savior. Stop shouting at your tribulation. Start gazing at your Savior, because the key to victory, the key to overcoming tribulation, listen, is worship. Listen, I realize this is a cliche. This will save your life. Worship is not just the four songs we do before I get up here and preach. In fact, worship's not really a song at all. Worship, it can be expressed in a song. But worship is a vision of Jesus that is bigger than the problem. It's a vision of Jesus and his love when it doesn't feel like love. Worship is a choice that you make in the midst of tribulation that says, I believe, even though I don't feel it, I believe Jesus is who the cross and resurrection tell me he is. It's a choice. Worship is a weapon that God gives you in the midst of the worst tribulation to rise above it and to be able to say, these problems are big and they're overwhelming and I don't see a way out of them yet, but you're bigger. And you're better, and I can trust you. Worship is when in the midst of tribulation, you say, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever the cost thou hast taught me to say, it's well with my soul because of who Jesus is. Yo, we began this service, we began this message by worshiping together as a congregation, didn't we? All right, why don't we end it the same way? You know the words of this song. Why don't we make this our declaration? All 11 campuses, why don't you stand together at all places right now as one body of people, okay? You stand here. You know the words, right? When peace like, don't leave me by myself, come on. River attendeth. Some of you are going through this with sorrows. When sorrows like sea billows roll. Whatever my lot, whatever you assign to me, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me. This is your declaration. Here it goes. It is well. It is well with my soul. Now you sing this as your declaration. Defy the powers at work. It is well. It is. My soul, with my soul, with my soul. Lift this up, your anthem now. This last verse, it's the Revelation 1.
And Lord, haste the day
when I'll see what John saw.
My face shall be sad.
You're gonna see this one day.
The clouds be rolled back as a scroll.
That's what John saw, Revelation 1. The trumpet shall resound.
The trumpet shall resound, and the Lord shall descend.
Even so,
it is well with my soul.
Say it from your heart. It is well, your declaration. Right now, our pastors and our prayer teams will come. They'll line the front of every campus. I've told you before, this is maybe the most important part of our service, because this is a time that we can take what is on you, these problems that overwhelm you, to the throne of God. And God will do miracles for some of you. We hear stories of it. We see it. God might heal the sick. He might bring the relationship back together. But what God might also do is give you a clear vision of who He is. And that's what we can offer to you infallibly every time, is a picture of Jesus. So don't just run out of here. If you got something you want to bring and have one of these brothers or sisters be here just to pray with you, at every campus, at every service, they'll be standing down front to be able to minister to you in that way. Summit Church, we are given a vision of Jesus that gives us assurance in the midst of tribulation. So I commend you to go in the knowledge of His love, the knowledge of His power, and the fullness of the Spirit that comes from knowing that everything that He has assigned for you to do, He will give you strength to accomplish. Summit Church, you are sent.